Good evening. At this time, we begin the TechNet on LiveArc. Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, gather the clan, and we discuss ham radio in a fairly serious vein. Your favorite transmitters, receivers, and antennas, and feed lines, and propagation, and modes, 26 different kinds of ham radio, lots of stuff we can discuss. The main subjects that are discussed at each TechNet are the subjects you guys bring. Once in a while, Mel will have a packaged program that he presents, but most of the time, the subjects that are discussed are the questions you guys ask. And you're allowed to ask questions on almost any subject of interest to ham radio operators. Usually it involves wireless and computers and RF and antennas and things like this. But occasionally we branch out a little bit into radio astronomy and optical astronomy and search for extraterrestrial intelligence and NASA space probes and so on. Amateur radio operators are curious people. They're interested in many areas of science, physics, math, and so on. So we cover a little bit of that from time to time. Not too many restrictions, as you can tell. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question and a comment from the net. Here we go. A question or a comment. Yes. For the net, exactly. That's why you would say yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2EO, Rich, and yes. And he'll be signing in tonight, and he'll be discussing a rubidium oscillator. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
N2EO, I'm here, Dick.
O-I Joe, yes. AC2AE, no. KI4NIL, yes.
KI4NIL, can you please tell us your name, sir?
I'm sorry, the name is Frank.
Okay, Frank with a yes, Rich with a yes, Joe with a yes. Mr. AE with a no. Do we have anyone else?
KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, name here is Joe, and no.
Good evening all, K2KEY.
Okay, we've got Mel, Joe number two, and anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Okay, Steve with a net, with a yes. Got more than enough. First guy who signed in was Rich. And Rich will discuss anything tonight except high stability oscillators. What would you like to talk about as a joke? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, you obviously got my email. Very good, N2EO, good evening. Dick, I've had this rubidium standard running all afternoon. I sent you a PDF file, I guess you read it. It says that it's good to 10 to the minus 12 in stability. I got some things I wrote down here, some notes I made. The default frequency is 8.388608 megahertz. And the calculated period, time it takes to complete one cycle, is 119.20928 microseconds. Now what I'm reading on the counter, and the counter's got a TCXO, I'm sure the counter is out a little. I'm seeing 8.388597 for the calculated period of 119.20943. That was a few hours ago. That 4.3 dropped to 4.1. So that's a difference. It was a difference of being high by 0.00015, now 00013 microseconds. I wonder how those numbers stack up to you, Dick. I'm a little getting confused on my powers of 10 here because I'm doing this without a scientific calculator. So so I'm having a little trouble maybe placing the decimal point. But I guess what I'd like to know is that this thing is actually locked. There's a lock indicator that's showing it's locked. They say it should run on 15 volts. I'm running it on 13.8. I don't think that's a problem. And I got a few other little tidbits for you, but let me turn it back to you, Dick. Maybe you can fill people in on what a rubidium oscillator is. And to we out.
Letting the machine drop in case anyone else wants to sign in from long distances. Oh, those numbers are terrible, Rich. It's time for you to mail that back to them and tell them it's out of spec. That's a joke. Those are darn good numbers, Rich. Not perfect. And the specification sheet does tell you what the drift rate is as a function of the supply voltage. So as you lower the supply voltage from 15 volts down to 13.8, you will get an extremely slight drift in frequency, according to the data sheet. So until you really feed it 15 volts, it's not a thoroughly fair test, although I think you should be within the right range, just like you said. When it comes to very high stability oscillators, there are a couple of classic techniques that have been used. In the very beginning, ham radio operators used no stability at all, just a spark gap. Eventually, we started using coils and capacitors to have a real tuned circuit. It didn't take very long for people to discover quartz crystals. And when you take a quartz crystal with the right cut into piezoelectric material, piezoelectric, piezoelectric, which really means when you apply a voltage to it, it bends, or when you bend it, it generates a voltage. It's a bidirectional phenomenon. And so by choosing a piece of quartz of the right shape, the right cut, the right thickness, mounting it correctly, you mechanically move it by applying voltage to it. And the voltage in turn gives it the movement in turn makes it to come back with a voltage. So it is a resonator. And a quartz crystal that's really done right, mounted correctly in a vacuum environment, is capable of having a Q of close to 1 million. Q has many definitions, quality factor, but one of the definitions is bandwidth divided by center frequency. So in theory, a Q of 1 million would mean that a crystal running at a 1 megacycle oscillating rate, would have a bandwidth of 1 hertz. One cycle of bandwidth at 1 megacycle, or 1 megahertz, of center frequency. That would be a Q of a million. And a quartz crystal can come very close to that. That's the good news. But the quartz does slowly drift in time, because as you run it year after year, repeater, time out. As you run it year after year, you're continuously mechanically moving it, and the small changes do take place. The quartz crystals do have an aging effect, but they're extremely good. The one thing not so nice about a quartz crystal is that with simple physical mechanical resonance, getting beyond 20 some odd megahertz is difficult. Crystals that are running higher than 20 some odd megacycles are running on the third harmonic, the fifth harmonic, the seventh harmonic, and so on. So there's really, if you could see the oscillation of the wafer of the crystal, there's multiple waves across the surface, if you know what I mean. It's not the one simple oil can operation as far as the mechanical motion is concerned. You know what the bottom of an oil can, the way it moves when you're squirting oil out of it. That's one of the modes of resonance of a crystal. So quartz is good. They soon discovered that even better are these rare earth materials, cesium and rubidium. Cesium and rubidium each have a resonating frequency somewhere in the 8 or 9 megahertz, 8 or 9 gigahertz region. But there the resonance is not a mechanical resonance. There is a kind of resonance of the molecule itself when it is running at the right temperature with the right gas pressure in the right tiny little cylinder. It has a natural resonant frequency, just like free hydrogen in space has a natural resonance frequency of 1420 megacycles. So quite a bit of radio astronomy has taken place by setting up a good radio telescope, and you aim the antenna in various directions in the sky and find out how strong is the 1420 megacycle signal that you see in that area that tells you how much hydrogen is there. And depending on whether the frequency you measure is slightly higher or slightly lower, you know that the hydrogen cloud is moving toward you or away from you, and you're experiencing Doppler shifts. You can do a whole lot of mapping of the universe by looking at the 1420 megacycle hydrogen resonance line. So by the same token, rubidium and cesium also have these natural molecular resonance phenomena to them. But the nice thing about both cesium and rubidium is that they have what's called a hyperline structure, hyperfine line structure. There are two oscillating molecular modes extremely close to each other. And when you operate the oscillator so that you're midway between those two modes of operation.
Repeater, timeout.
Midway between those two modes of oscillation, you're getting an extreme accuracy of frequency. Rubidium is better on short-term stability than cesium. Cesium is better on long-term stability. So if you bought a really expensive frequency reference oscillator like they use at the National Bureau of Standards and like some broadcast stations like PBS Channel 13 uses at their broadcast center, you have a cesium beam oscillator which is disciplining a rubidium oscillator, which in turn is disciplining a 10 megacycle ZCXO, voltage-controlled, crystal-controlled oscillator. So step by step, you get higher and higher short-term stability, longer and longer long-term stability when you make the right combination. The stability, the reference oscillator assembly that Rich recently purchased on eBay, is the rubidium type. Quite a few of the cell site base stations are using a rubidium reference oscillator. Another technique that people have used is to occasionally check their oscillator against global positioning satellite receivers, a global positioning satellite. They also have an extremely high accuracy reference oscillator on board. So eventually, you're going to be probably correcting the reference oscillator that's in your frequency counter, and both of those you're going to check against a broadcast station, a global positioning satellite receiver, or National Bureau of Standards, WWV. So there are various ways you can check. And I think one of the things you've got to do, let me drop, in your particular case, is to find out how to reprogram your particular oscillator, which I think is capable of going from anything like 1 hertz up to 20 megahertz by programming. And it has a frequency resolution of 10 to the minus 12. 10 to the minus 12 means that you can set it at plus or minus 10 millihertz when you're running at 10 megahertz. That's the kind of accuracy you're able to set that thing, if I understand the specification correctly. Looks like a fun machine, and you should have a lot of fun with it. Joe, W2LYY, has also been doing quite a bit of checking with stability of his reference oscillators that are in his IFR or whatever his service monitor was. And as you know, we also have a man in New Jersey who right now is having trouble remembering his call letters, who has done some very significant work. And probably he will chime in. Hopefully, he'll come back and tell us what he thinks of all this. Back to you, Rich, and tell us where you stand on that reprogramming process. Make sure you wait until the machine really drops in case anyone else wants to join us. N2EO with a delay, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, on frequency.
Yeah, glad you're there, John, and I'm very forgetful. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, and my guess is if you give Rich your email address, he will mail you a copy of the data he has received so far on his rubidium oscillator. And I'll bet you're also running a rubidium oscillator. Is that true, John? KD2BD, K2LIW?
No, negative. I'm running a plain old crystal oscillator that's temperature compensated. This is an oscillator that I purchased through Balmar Crystals a bunch of years ago. It was a special order item. And that runs at 10 megahertz, and I have that disciplined to WWVB's carrier at 60 kilohertz. And through that arrangement, I'm getting, from what I can see, at least one part per billion accuracy, and with a homebrew frequency counter that's using that crystal as a reference, I'm able to measure down to 10 digits, which is also one part per billion resolution. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
To me, one pod per billion is 9 decimal places. You said 10 decimal places. Wouldn't that be one pod, 10 to the minus 10? Now, John, go ahead.
I had to seek it out once, and it came out to be one pod per billion. I'm thinking, well, there's 10 digits on the display. I can read down to 0.01 hertz, I believe. I think when I figured that out, it came out to be one part per billion.
0.001 hertz with millihertz, millihertz for 10 megs. I think that's one part per 10 billion. But we'll have to double check that. But you're getting there. And frequency accuracy measurements is another whole art and science that's a lot of fun for people into high technology. I think I told you, there's a guy I used to talk to periodically on the microwave bands who lived in northern Connecticut, who worked for a broadcast station, and he would listen to the global, he would listen to the synchronous satellites when they were locked up to a network program and measure the frequency accuracy of those. And occasionally he would see a little bit of a cyclic drift, positive and negative, on a 24-hour period. And he soon realized that what was going on is that the satellite in orbit was very slightly elliptical in its orbit. It wasn't a perfectly circular orbit. And therefore, periodically, the satellite was coming toward him and going away from him. That's why the 24-hour period of cyclicity to the slight frequency drift he was experiencing. Ain't that amazing that sitting on the ground, making measurements with laboratory equipment, with stuff you can set up with not too much difficulty, at our ham radio station, we can literally measure the rate at which a synchronous satellite 22,300 miles away in orbit around the Earth, six Earth radius distances away, whether or not that satellite is drifting around in space, and you can make those measurements. It's kind of fun. So I imagine you'll eventually get into this kind of jazz, Rich. N2EO, K2IYW in the second half.
This case is KEY. And I also had a question, sir.
Go ahead with your question now, Mel.
Okay, I have a loop frequency counter that they came out with, I guess it's 15 years old at least, because of what they did, the original model had Nixie tubes in it. And it was then a model, the same model, in fact, I think it was almost the same model. They came out and they replaced it with the digital type of MAN displays instead of, I guess they just pulled out the Nixie tubes. But they have a crystal oven in there. It's a 10 megahertz reference. And they said if you leave it plugged in, what you can expect is one part 10 to the minus 9 accuracy, or another way it said it is one part per million per month, or plus or minus 10 hertz per month, Dick, was using a crystal oven, over.
If you choose the right kind of a cut of a quartz crystal where it has an extremely low temperature coefficient of frequency, sometimes measured in hertz per degree Celsius or Fahrenheit, that combined with an extremely good oven, quartz crystal can do very well. Many of the very accurate reference oscillators made by the Hewlett-Packard company back in their day were exactly that, a 10-meg crystal, very carefully done in a precisely temperature-controlled oven. And the rubidium oscillator that Rich is now using probably is something like 10 to 1 better than that. So they're coming along very nicely. Rubidium, I think, lasts longer than cesium, and you should be pretty happy with it. I think people talk about 10-year lifespan, if not more. And with your level of affluence there, Rich, buying another one in 10 years is not going to be much of a problem. And keeping track of what it says compared to National Bureau standards or whatever other reference you eventually decide to use should be kind of fun. I see the day when you're going to be bringing your oscillator and a power supply so you can continuously be powering up its oven down to one of Andy WHUCDL's tune-up clinic at a Limark meeting, and we'll find out how accurate is the reference oscillator inside of the service monitor that Andy is using. That should be kind of fun. And he now is working for an organization that gives him access to other kinds of oscillators that are pretty nice and stable. So, any other further comments, Rich, and let us know how you make progress in finding out how to reprogram that thing. I wonder if the programming is serial or parallel. If it is a serial word that it needs in order to set the frequency that comes out, that's going to be a little bit more of a problem for you. Whereas with parallel, you can do it with a bunch of, you know, on-off switches, so to speak. N2EO, KQLRW in the deck next.
Okay, Jacob, making it over there?
Yes, you are. Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, N2EO. Yeah, it programs serial via RS-232. The gentleman who wrote this article supplied a program. I have the program. Haven't installed it yet. It gives you the divide by N number to plug in there to set it for 10 megahertz. So I'll be doing that in the next few days. What I wanted to ask you, Dick, what I neglected to do, and I don't think it matters, if you look at the article, he came out where he's taking off that jack for the oscillator. He's coming off with a piece of semi-rigid hardline. And I just didn't see a need for that. So what I did was I used Teflon silver-plated coax, ran it out the back through a single-hole BNC connector. Anything wrong with that, Dick?
Nothing at all wrong with that, Rich. That's not going to give you a problem. If you wanted to be super careful, I guess you could have made a double-shielded coax cable, but no. There aren't any super strong signals inside that cabinet. You have to shield some. Semi-rigid is a little bit nice mechanically as far as a shock and vibration is concerned. But you're not going to be mounting this thing in an airplane right alongside an engine where it's going to be continuously vibrated, where the flexible cable would give you trouble and the semi-rigid cable would not. So I wouldn't worry. And that serial word, for me, that would represent a little bit of a problem. What kind of instrumentation are you going to use, Rich, in order to generate that serial word? Go ahead.
Okay, well, yeah, I didn't leave a pause there. Maybe I should have. All right. I made the connection for the RS-32 today. It's just TX in and RX out. You'll probably get it in. And it gives you it's a hexadecimal number they give you the output frequency 10 megahertz F32.0 AD R60. And he tells you to program in letter is an echo, which holds it in all the time. I don't think it'll be a problem. You never know. I don't think. But you know what's screwing me up? It's a stupid little thing. I couldn't find a DB9 connector to put on the end of the cable so I could hook it to the RS-232. I was at Radio Shack today. They're still mailing me one, but it's going to take 5 business days to get it from Fort Worth. They had 15 pins. But they didn't have 9-pin that we were running. I plan, Dick, on mounting the whole unit inside a Hammond die-cast box. You remember the boxes like with the microwave module black boxes came in? Something like that with its own 15-volt power supply, an indicator showing lock, and an indicator showing unlock. Action
at N2EO. I also got another question to K2KE1.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Years ago, they used the standard LORAN signal as a standard. Is that completely defunct now, over?
I guess John can give us a better word on that. Have you ever used NORAD, John, KD2BD? LORAN.
No, negative. I've heard the signal on 100 kilohertz, and my understanding is that it's still on the air and it's still being used, but not for much longer. K2RAW from KD2BD.
Now, you've used 60 kilohertz. At first, my first impression of using 100 kilohertz is because of the drift of the ionosphere up and down. You're going to be getting a continuous error. Integrate for a longer period of time, and that problem goes away. But, as I said, I would have guessed that 100 kilohertz is not that easy to use as a reference for that reason. But here you are using 60% of that, 60 kilohertz. And so, for you, it has worked out extremely well. And I guess what you've done is to learn what is the cyclicity, the cyclic rate of the change of the ionosphere, or D-layer, or whatever, and therefore you know which times of the day the rate of phase shift of the 60 kilohertz will be increasing or decreasing. Is that somewhat true, John? Back to you, John. KD2BD, K2LIW.
Very true, John.
John first, and then we'll pick up Eric. Go ahead, John.
Okay, yes. Actually, I think it was last week I sent you and Mel a link to propagation maps for JJY, which is in Japan. They run two long-wave broadcast stations in Japan, one on 40 kilohertz, one on 60 kilohertz for dissemination of time and frequency information. And that's an animated image that they show. Where you see ripples in the signal strength contours around the time of sunset and sunrise. And the same sort of thing happens here in the United States. And as long as you stay away from sunset or sunrise time out near Fort Collins, Colorado, things are pretty stable. And if you could withstand about 15 part per billion inaccuracy, then you don't have to worry about that either. K2RW from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. Thank you for that information. Eric, KE2EJ, how do you go about setting your cesium, rubidium, and whatever standards that you use? KE2EJ from CBS Television, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Just a word on Loran C. I forgot the system. If you go to the Coast Guard website, you'll find that on February 26th of 2009, the Office of Management and Budget publicly announced the President's fiscal year 2010 budget, and it supports determination of outdated systems such as the terrestrial-based long-range navigation, the LORAN C, which is operated by the Coast Guard, and they show you how much money they're going to save. So that answers that question. They actually did shut a station down, I think it was 2 years ago. They're operating at a very minimal amount. I don't remember exactly where the stations are, but I've run across this thing once a few times and seen and tested some gear out on a boat that a few people use. It's an interesting system and very accurate from what I understand. Cesium tubes are really only warranted for 3 years. You can probably get 5 to 7 years out of them, even 10 years if you're really careful about it and never get them off. But they're damn accurate. I mean, if once they're going, and they only oscillate at one frequency, and one frequency only, it's around 21 gigs. I forget exactly what the number is, but as far as accuracy is concerned, if the little idiot light is lit, it's accurate.
Do you happen to know the approximate lifetime of a rubidium standard, Eric? Go ahead.
Depends on the manufacturer's operator. The ones that they use in the television business, you can still to this day buy rubidium sync generators. They're actually 10 megahertz oscillators that drive the sync generator. And they're supposed to last in the order of something like 10 years.
I vaguely remember that the definition of 1 second by the National Bureau of Standards or by the NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology, Standards and Technology, is 9.1 blank, blank, blank million cycles of a cesium oscillator. So I think it's a 9.1 gigahertz, but I could be wrong. And I think the rubidium is somewhere around 8 in the fraction gigahertz. We got to check on that one. And so inside of your oscillator, Rich, there probably is a countdown circuit, and what you're really doing is programming that countdown circuit as you put in that serial word. And are you going to be using your computer to generate that serial word to feed into the oscillator in order to tell it that you want 10 megacycles of output? Is that approximately what you're going to do, Rich? M2EO, K2RIW?
That's correct, Dick. They have you use a terminal program in Windows by Hyperterm, but I can send you the actual program that somebody in AMSAT wrote. It came in with a package of information. I should have sent you that program. You may want to pass it on to interested parties. But it's a program dedicated for this particular unit. Like I said, I haven't installed it yet. I need a computer with a RS-232 port. All the new computers like what I have here have USB. I don't know if a USB to RS-232 converter is going to work. I need it also for another purpose too. So I'm waiting on that and a couple of other things, and then we'll get it programmed. Dick, how can I double check this? I mean, I hate to go on faith. Also, I'm reading out, like I said before, period of the wave, time it takes to complete one cycle. I'm showing 119.20941. How does that translate to times 10 to the minus what? 119.20941. That's as far out as I can read. I've got a BNK counter here, goes to 3 gigs, has a TCXO, but I'm sure this should be much more stable than it. And I don't know how to actually double check this. I can't use, I was thinking maybe there's some way to use a listages pattern with WWV, but I don't think that's going to work, can it, Dick?
Hey, Dick, it's 9192631770. It's 9.192 gigs.
I kind of thought so. You're talking about the frequency of cesium now, and I think that is the definition of a one second period by the NIST. X number of cycles of a cesium oscillator. And so I'm kind of amazed that when they first started using those lots and lots of years ago, that they had solid-state countdown circuits that would operate that high at 9.1 gigahertz. But obviously they did. And my guess is you can also set your reference oscillator at whatever output frequency you desire, probably to the nearest millihertz or so at 10 megacycles. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
You know, the oscillator, I forgot a couple things in it. It'll let you phase a 10 megahertz oscillator, so that way you can phase a bunch of these clocks together and do averages. I have two of them. I have one at home. I have one at work. Actually, one of them was part of an experiment done by the Naval Observatory where they put one of these oscillators on a very fast-moving jet for a period of time. They synced them on the ground, flew it around really quick. I think it was like Mach 3 or Mach 4 or something like that. I don't remember what the number is. But as fast as you can go in a fighter jet, and then put it back on the ground and check for the difference in time for looking for Einstein's theory of relativity. And it's just interesting to have that. I can thank Dr. Bill for that one. But it allows you to move the position of the oscillator. You know, you actually have a full rotation of a complete sine wave in terms of moving it in phase, and I think you can move it in increments of 0.0000, 1, 2, 3, 4, 0.050 or 60. in terms of phase, though. It's got a very accurate divider and a counter, and you can move it. So that way you can phase up a couple clocks.
And then flying an airplane around experiment to confirm relativity. If I first move the airplane from the east to the west in the direction that the Earth is rotating, I'll have a certain specific velocity at which it's losing time. But then when I reverse the airplane and come back, you would think it would cancel. If the airplane flew in one direction around the Earth, now I'm going to accumulate some relativity. But if I fly it to the east for a while at Mach 3, then turn around and fly to the west for a while at Mach 3, and come back to the same airport, wouldn't you come close to canceling? And by the way, when they did that experiment, did it confirm what they wanted to see, if you remember, Eric, K2EJ, K2LIW?
K2LIW, K2EJ. Don't forget I'm getting this information third hand. It's an old story. But to minimize all the variables, what they did was the reference that was on the ground, they very slowly moved it to the place where the airplane landed. That way they wouldn't have the effect of flying it back in the other direction. I believe that's what the story was. There's more that goes to it, but it's not clear. It's just, it's been handed down, so I don't know how much of it is accurate.
Okay. Yeah. You're really at the limit of what you can measure in an experiment like that, because that airplane is flying an extremely small fraction of the speed of light, and that's where you would really get some relativistic effects, even though Mach 3, by your and my standards, is very, very fast. And about the only airplane I know of that can fly Mach 3 for any significant period of time is an SR-71 Blackbird, Lockheed Blackbird. That's an airplane. And if you ever see one of those up close, mine, otherwise, the thing looks like it's moving a zillion miles an hour when it's sitting on the ground. Okay, Eric, and Rich, I'm going to go on to the next guy, which I think is Frank, KI4NIL. What would you like to ask us tonight, Frank? KI4NIL, KQRYW on the deck net.
WS2N on the last comment.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, the theory is if you take a rocket and you go near the speed of light and go out and then come back again at the speed of light, you would think that, you're going to come back to the same point. But when you come back, it's going to be many, many years into the future. So, that takes care of that. It's just the speed. It's not the idea of coming back.
Understand. Okay. Frank, KI4NIL, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Been listening for a while. All your technical stuff is way beyond my knowledge. I have a real easy question. My HF rig is in the car, and I'd like to make some kind of a 20-meter simple antenna, either something I can mount on a tripod and fold up, or something I can hang in a tree. And I wondered if anybody had any simple suggestions.
Yeah, that's an area that Mel should know about, and the guys who do a lot of field-based type operations. K2KEY. Mel, I wonder if you've got a suggestion. K2LIW.
Well, the simplest thing to do, like we do, is we go down to the park here. We have every year, we have a little outing at the park. And usually, the best antenna I found that very effective is a simple dipole for 20 meters. And how do I rig it? At the park, of course, you're not allowed to shoot bone arrows, slingshots, or any of those things. That's a no-no for sure. You don't want to get arrested. And so what I use is I have a rubber ball. It actually is a hard rubber ball that, I remember the kids way, way back, the blue collar, had a funny name to it. I don't remember what it was, but a specific name to it. But it's very easy to toss with a piece of cord hanging on it. And I just toss it over one limb of the tree and stretch out the wire. to another limb of a tree and pull it up with a couple of pieces of string, actually, very, very quick to install it with a simple feed line, Mini 8U I use. And we're in business. That's when you want to take it down, you just disconnect the cord and let it drop and roll it up. I don't think it can go any simpler than that, Dick. And literally, no cost, over.
WS2N Comet.
Yeah, how would you solve the problem, Paul?
Okay, very good, Dick. I bought years ago from Sears this rope with a chainsaw in the middle. And that's all it is, to cut branches down. And it comes with a heavy weight, a sandbag. And you take this and swing it around and throw that up into the trees. And it goes over the branch, it comes back down. And then what happens is you're able to set to the saw that's in between the rope and cut branches. Well, you take the same sandbag, it's just on a little clip. And what you do is I take that and put that to the end of a rope and I swing that up into the trees and I pull up the dipoles that way. So it serves two purposes. I could use it for, you're always going to have to cut a couple of branches out of your way when you put the dipole up. And, it's always going to be hung up on something. So you could utilize it for that and for throwing your dipoles into the trees. That really works very well. I mean, it's meant for that purpose. You know, you take this thing and just swing it around and throw it up to get the rope up there to cut your branches. So I use it for the dipoles as well.
Yeah, the thing that Paul is talking about is sold by Sears Roebuck. It's called a high limb trimming saw. I own one, and it comes with a bean bag or a sandbag on each end, or one end, and if you let out about 2 feet of rope with a bean bag on the end of the rope, and then swing it in a circular motion, and at just the right time in that circular motion, when you build up some good velocity, you let go of it, you can get some reasonable altitude out of that. 20 feet, I believe, is doable. To go beyond that, because I got some limbs that I wanted to trim on my trees that are at a 60-foot altitude, I would take a carp fishing reel, which is on the end of a compound bow, and with a monofilament line connected to the back of the arrow, I can shoot that more than 100 feet into the air. And if you're really accurate with the way you use it, the arrow will go over a limb almost 100 feet high, tow down the monofilament string that's being displayed by the front of this carp fishing reel, which really is a reel about a foot and a half in diameter with the monofilament line wrapped on it, and it's coming off the edge of it, very similar to a spinning wheel. Picture a spinning rod where the wind-up is now a foot and a half in diameter instead of the normal 3 inches in diameter. That's what a carp fishing setup on a compound bow is. Obviously, you're not allowed to use any of this bow and arrow type stuff in a park, and you're not going to be cutting limbs in a park either. So this is something that Paul's talking about that you do in your own backyard. So I have been able to, with that, trim tree limbs at a very high altitude, at least 60 or 70 feet up. On one particular occasion, I was very glad my feet didn't get tangled in the rope that was on the ground. By the way, I was extending the ropes on the end of this high limb trimming saw in the process of trimming a limb that was very high up. And the limb that I finally did trim probably was quite a few hundred pounds of wood. And when it came roaring down and dug into the ground in front of me, it was quite an exciting event. I was awful glad it didn't hit me because it could have done an awful lot of damage. So we've got to be kind of careful with these things. So I guess these are some of the methods by which you can do it. I know that they sell a repeater.
Time out.
I know they sell a very nice slingshot setup for in the back of QSP magazine for putting a weight up into the air, a sinker on a monofilament line. And the monofilament line draws up a string, the string draws up a rope, the rope draws up a guy wire or an antenna or whatever. Is one of the processes for getting something pretty heavy in the air over a tree. And trees are very nice natural supports for these kind of antennas. Lance, K2EJD, I guess it is, WA2EJD, Eating Jelly Donuts, a member of this particular club, has quite a few of these Army pieces of tubing that he sets up at a field day site by which he's able to erect the antennas. So there are some of those setups that are kind of handy. They fold them very small, and when they're all collapsible, put into a trunk of a car. And so you create your own very high tripod, so to speak, for supporting an antenna if there happens to be no local trees. Dipoles are probably the easiest kind of antenna you can set up on HF frequencies. The next step beyond that, of course, starts getting pretty complicated pretty fast with things like rotary Yagis, which as a temporary setup at HF frequencies is not appropriate. The VHF guys do that all the time on mountaintops. Maybe this helps a little bit, Frank. KI4NIL. And how close to Monroe, Connecticut are you going to be setting these things up, Frank? K2LIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Dick, comment W2EWK. A very important comment.
Yeah, hold on there, Eugene. Frank first, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. No, I live in Monroe. I would be setting it up in Monroe. I know that Monroe kind of has a reputation as not an amateur radio-friendly town, but I'm not going to panic about that. One of my questions is, first of all, the dipole thing I understand, and I guess I will try to look up a 20-meter wire dipole on the Internet and see if I can build one, because I built the J-pole I'm talking on now on 2 meters, so I've at least built an antenna before. And you're saying if I made a Yagi, like a directional 20-meter antenna, it wouldn't be possible to make it very small. I guess the thing would end up being rather large.
Well, there's a yes or no to that. A number of guys have realized that what a Yagi really is a number of parasitic elements plus a driven element. Those parasitic elements, in some cases, if you've got the right kind of support in the right area, everything doesn't have to be rotatable, and it doesn't have to be very large in diameter. So if you're really crafty with the way you set up ropes, you can make a wire rope suspended Yagi antenna. A rope suspended catenary Yagi antenna. There are ways of doing that. I didn't say it's the first antenna you should build, but put that in the back of your mind that it's possible to do it. Guys have, with a pair of ropes, set up very long, multiple element Yagis on 2 meters to do moon bounce, and there's nothing stopping you from doing it on HF frequencies. And the fact is going to be a little bit of a tilt to the antenna where it's got an elevation to it, because you're suspending it from a tree and pulling the ropes out to one side, you know, 3 or 4 times the tree altitude away. You'll have a little bit of slope to those ropes with the wires in between them that represents the Yagi. Because the Yagi itself might have a 40-degree V-width and you're tilting it at 15 degrees, don't worry about it. That all works out very nicely. So that's another approach, the next step above. But simple wire dipole antennas are certainly a very good beginning. Eugene, what would you like to add to all this? W2EWK, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2EWK. Very important, Dick. The slingshot that you saw inside the QST magazine, any slingshot in New York State or Connecticut State is against the law now. It is a felony if you get caught with a slingshot. No matter what you use it for, it is against the law. But be careful if you do have one, QSL.
Absolutely. We'll be careful. If I use it on my own property, and as long as I don't offend my neighbors, I don't think I'm going to run into that problem. But yes, if I go into a public area with that kind of a weapon, I am subject to being arrested. I accept that. On my own property, I don't think it's really a problem. But yeah, there's a number of rules like that which the letter of the law and the intent of the law look like they differ a little bit. But most likely, these guys are going to be using beanbags or a rubber ball on the end of a string, and that's not much of a weapon, and I don't think we've got to worry very much. How soon do you need this? You're going to be setting it up for a field day site sometime in the near future, Frank. KI4NIL, K2LIW.
K2YO.
K2YO, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. K2YO, Bernie. Just a quick interjection. A slingshot is not illegal in New York. A wrist rocket is illegal in New York. We use slingshots without wrist braces in the cabling industry to pull cables over drop ceilings. So need to do a little more research on that, but a slingshot without a wrist brace is legal in New York.
Very fine. Thank you, Bernie, for that information. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, yeah, there is no particular timetable for the antenna. I just, I've had only a little bit of luck with HF. I started out with a 20-meter hamstick when I bought an ICOM 706 in October. The hamstick was bad. It took a couple hours to figure out what the problem was, but I finally whittled it down to the antenna was the only thing that was wrong. So I was using the steel whip from the top of the 20-meter hamstick in a Wilson CB antenna, and I got an SWR of about 2.5, and I talked to Jamaica and Canada and Florida and stuff. It wasn't great, though. I bought a Hustler 20-meter, and I talked to someone in Kansas right away, and since then I haven't talked to a soul. I don't know exactly what the problem is. It could just be the weather. But it would be nice if I could hook up something where... understandably, I wouldn't be able to drive the car, but that I could do some better HF work. The radio is great, but I've got some poor choices for antennas, it appears.
Yeah, I sense that you're going to be doing mobile operations simply because in your own town or maybe in your apartment building, setting up antennas is almost a restriction. Is that what's going on here, Frank?
Well, no. At the time that I bought the radio, I was living in an apartment in Arizona, and it was definitely going to be mobile only. The company I worked for closed. I came back. I'm living with my parents. I did just find a job recently, so hopefully I'll be moving out eventually, but in the meantime, it would be cool, it would be cool to do some real HF work. I've managed to hear people in California, Texas, Nevada. I heard a guy in Guam loud and clear. He was bringing in about an S9. But there was no chance of me being able to hit him. And it would be nice to do something. So I'm wondering, the dipole, is it going to have that kind of performance, or would a directional antenna be better? And when speaking of a directional antenna, is it possible to make a Yagi small enough that it would be like one-third wave or quarter wave on 20 meters?
Okay, there are ways of taking a Yagi-like antenna and shrinking it down. I almost don't recommend that, Frank. The performance does degrade, the bandwidth gets very narrow, properly tuning it and whatever is a bit difficult. Also, when it comes to ground plane-like antennas, vertical antennas, one of the things that many guys eventually discover is that measuring the standing wave ratio is only half of the battle. If there aren't a large enough number of ground plane radials below the antenna, you end up coupling quite a bit of your RF energy into the ground, and it becomes wasted, and you don't know about that. The antenna can be running at pretty low efficiency. You may hear guys very well, but they're not going to hear you very well. And I know at first that sounds like a violation of reciprocity, but there is an explanation for all of that. Dipoles up in the air at a reasonable altitude do give you an extremely high standardized repeatable performance, whereas a ground plane antenna on the Earth directly without enough ground plane radios can be kind of low in performance, even though it looks like it's working like a charm and it's a very pretty structure. So you're going in the right direction with the dipoles. And then if you really have to have more gain at a later time, the next step above that is either multiple dipoles and use them as a phased array, that's one approach, or really setting up a rope Yagi, or eventually having a real rotatable Yagi, although on HF frequencies that requires quite a bit of rigmarole, real estate, hardware, and whatever. You may not want to go there immediately, particularly when you're living under temporary conditions until you find out what your permanent location is going to be. Once you're in your permanent location and you choose a mountaintop QTH with a nice piece of land and you set up a radio tower on that piece of land, Frank, then ham radio is going to become a lot more fun. So you got something to look forward to. It's a little bit like the guy who buys a sailboat and he looks forward to the day when he can buy a bigger one and sleep more people on it. Well, we amateurs, we look forward to the day that we buy a house with a bigger piece of land, higher above sea level, with the permission to put up a radio tower, and we put up more and more antennas. And in the case of simple wire antennas, let me drop
repeater. Time out.
In the case of simple wire antennas, they're so inexpensive, and each one can be set up in slightly different directions, slightly different polarizations, with the right kind of a switching network in the shack. You can decide which one you use on what day, during what hour of the day, maybe even use them in combination. And you can get electronic steering and electronic phased array effects where you enhance the signal in one particular direction. So there's lots of different ways of doing it. We amateurs don't build our transmitters and receivers anymore on HF frequencies, but we certainly build a lot of our antennas and test them. That's one of the areas where the experimentation is an awful lot of fun. So check in with us periodically. Let us know how your project is going and what you discover. There are some pretty nice articles on antenna compendium in the antenna handbook from AR Orel. And there's also books on stealthy installations, in other words, antennas that don't show but still give high performance under restricted locations. There's quite a bit of literature on the subject if you do enough of a search. And so good luck with that project. And I'm going to move on to the next guy now, who I think is Joe from A2RYY. I think he had a question. Let's find out if he did. A2RYY, A2RYW. You got it, Joe.
W2OS Salt Lake, check in with traffic.
And WS2N, I forgot. Put me down for a space report, Dick.
Okay. Bob, why don't you go ahead with your traffic?
Okay, Dick, thank you. W2OSR. I am in the process of attempting to convert Ethernet SB1000 to a 6-meter operation. I have a question about the high input and the high output on the amplifier. In particular, what Q should it be?
Okay, there are two people who checked in before you, Bob. So not to get them angry, I'm going to go to them first, and then we're going to come back to your question. Is that okay?
That's absolutely fine by me. I expected you to, I was surprised it took me so soon.
I understand. In other words, you were checking in to go on the list, and I guess I didn't sense that. When you said traffic, I thought you had a point of order. I thought Mr. Secretary was bringing us a point of order that we had to discuss immediately. Joe, to V2RYY, you're right ahead if you're there and you've got a question.
Good evening, Dave. This is Joe, W2RYY. I have a question on VHF propagation. Is it possible, I guess it is, it's more than possible to actually experience it, but I had seen a couple of nights ago watching a particular television channel, and tell me if you've ever seen this perhaps before, maybe you could explain what the reasoning is behind it or what happens. On Channel 3, I was getting WFSD from Hartford. I was getting their audio, but the picture on the same channel, I was getting KYW from Philadelphia. I could clearly see, well, relatively clearly see the picture. Some interference behind it, I guess, another channel. But have you ever seen something like that before, where the at the low end of the within a 6 meg space, the propagation comes one way, and at the higher end, it comes from another direction? I never had that happen before on television channel. Have you?
I don't think I've ever seen that. And now I'm trying to figure out what could possibly do it. The audio of an NTSC television channel, Channel 3, 4.5 megs above the video, is going into a relatively narrow receiver, which I guess is something like 25 kilohertz wide. 25 kilohertz, I think, is the deviation used on the audio for National Television Selection Committee, NTSC type, Ordinary American Analog Television. So, you've got a relatively narrow band receiver for the audio, and you've got a close to 4 megacycle receiver for the video. That makes a difference in threshold magnitude. Still, though, even that doesn't completely explain it, how you get the audio from one and the video from the other. Huh. Now, don't have a great explanation for that one, Bob. and only 4.5 makes a difference. Channel 3 is, let's see, 50, 60 to 66 megacycles.